From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
This is completely transparent. It's on the floor of the House. It's an open vote. People have just voted. And again, our purpose is to facilitate and to begin to move forward in the budget making.
We're being asked to address on the merits for the first time without a committee as something that was put in on the floor today, an appropriations bill of importance, something we all value. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an absolute sham, carrying over from yesterday's sham. It is embarrassing to me, to all of us here, that we're wasting our time and energy in such a form.
I want this to be the greatest city in the world for everyone, for every family, in every neighborhood. But the city, like the state, is at a critical point, a tipping point. We can't continue to govern from crisis to crisis, bandaging over problems for as long as we can, and hoping to survive for another few years while we slowly, slowly slide down the scale of great cities.
That's Governor Bruce Rauner addressing the Chicago City Council this week. Before that, we heard from House Speaker Michael Madigan and Republican Representative Ron Sandak debating about the debate taking place in the Illinois House also this week. But we are going to forget all of that for at least the start of the show today, because as we go to air, the Illinois Supreme Court has ruled that the pension legislation passed here a couple years ago is unconstitutional. We're going to be talking about that this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. Bill Wheelhouse is away. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Amanda Vinicky by phone, WUIS and Illinois Public Radio Statehouse Bureau Chief, and Jamie Dunn, editor of Illinois Issues magazine. Let's dive right into it. Amanda, I'm going to start with you. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what the Illinois Supreme Court said today?
Well, we have a unanimous opinion from the state's high court that really came out of nowhere. Typically, you get advance warning, not this time, but the state Supreme Court says that Senate Bill 1, that's that big pension overhaul, is unconstitutional. What was really telling to me was that the court said the General Assembly has basically forced retirees alone to, quote, bear public burdens, which, in all fairness and justice, should be borne by the public as a whole, and shot down the argument that Illinois has some sort of fiscal emergency, saying there can't be a fiscal emergency, or at least one for which all options were exhausted for dealing with, given that the income tax increase was allowed to expire at the start of 2015. So big news on a Friday morning.
Yeah, and listeners hear this show at different times during the weekend in the State Week universe, but we are reading this. It's still relatively fresh, but Jamie, you've had a chance to look through the opinion. And what stands out to you about some of the things that Justice Carmeier wrote here?
Yeah, I got a quick read through, and you know, he goes all over the political historical map. It's kind of a greatest hits for folks who are interested in that sort of thing. He harkens back to the 1970 Constitution floor debate. He talks or includes some floor debate on the pension bill itself. At one point, he references the Federalist Papers, so it just it goes kind of all over the place. But the big takeaway from it, from all of those components, for me, was this is an issue that has been a tension between funding public services and funding benefits since pension benefits existed, and that it's lawmakers' job to make sure that both things are funded in the way that they need to be funded. Basically, this is your problem, legislators and state government and governor, to solve. You need to solve it. The Supreme Court is not going to solve it for you.
Yeah, well, Charlie, Amanda mentioned that we were kind of surprised by the short notice we got for this opinion, but I think, and you're not the gloating type, but you are probably the person least surprised by this. You've been predicting this outcome for years now.
Yeah, and I mean, for me to gloat over the fact I predicted it, it would be like me gloating over the fact that I will predict today that tomorrow will be Saturday. I mean, this was so obvious. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that the opinion pointed out was that the same forces that are at work now are what motivated the Constitutional Convention delegates to put that language into the charter. And it was raised at the time by some veteran lawmakers, if you put this language into the new Constitution, we won't be ever able to change benefits in the future. And the response was, well, no duh, that's the whole point. And as a matter of fact, back then, in 1970, the pensions were funded at about the same level, percentage-wise, as they are today. And so the opinion should have come as no surprise to anyone. It was pretty clear. And as Justice Carmeier pointed out, you can't come in and argue that, oh, we have no other option other than to trash the Constitution, when you're willing to let billions of dollars go by the wayside by not extending the temporary income tax rates.
Yeah, and Charlie, Justice Carmeier also mentioned the re-amortization that you have talked about in the past. Amanda, I'm going to turn to you, though. Can you give us just a little bit of a background as a refresher? What is wrong with the Illinois pension systems in the view of the legislature and former Governor Quinn that they felt they had to enact this drastic legislation?
$111 billion worth of wrong, really. Illinois has the nation's worst funded pension systems, and that is because if you talk to a couple people, they'll say, hey, look at these instances of how rich benefits are for certain individuals, but that's really not it. There are a couple of those circumstances. Really, this has been brought about because for many years, the state did not put in the employer's share into the retirement funds, and therefore you had underfunded. And that was exacerbated when Illinois and the rest of the nation went through the recession, and so it has just compounded over time. You'll have critics that say, you know, the unions say, this is evidence. This is not a problem that we created. Workers put in their share toward their retirement benefits. It comes straight out of their paychecks. They can't do anything about it. They've done what they were supposed to. It's the state fault. It's politicians' fault. There will be those, however, who point out that there were basically tacit agreements for many years with unions who were all too happy to get money pumped into other programs or to see their members get raises, even if it meant that that year's pension payment would not be fully made. So that's what has really brought us to this situation.
Now, I think in a broader sense, what it's all about is that for decades, for as long as I've been watching this stuff, and it goes back to the days of the Constitutional Convention in 1970, there's always been the desire on the part of governors and lawmakers of both parties to give constituents what they want in terms of services and programs and capital projects. And on the other hand, not to take the tough stance that would be needed to say, you want all this stuff, you got to pay for it. And the way to avoid paying for it and give people the goodies for free, so to speak, was to just look at this one area that says, as the employer, we're responsible to put away enough money each year so that when the benefits come due in the future for teachers, for state university employees like all of us, for other state workers, the money will be there. And for, I guess, forever, the actuarially required amount needed to cover the benefits earned in a given year has not been set aside. Instead, that money's been used for other things. And it's not all waste and fraud and abuse. It's worthwhile programs that the lawmakers wanted, governors wanted, because constituents wanted it. But on the other hand, they didn't have the political courage to tell constituents, you want this stuff, you got to pay for it. The way you pay for it is by higher taxes.
You know, Charlie,
it was a way that for them to have their cake and eat it too,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. That's a great point, Charlie. Some people have actually given Governor Quinn credit for making the actuarially required payments when he was—
No, he still hasn't made—
Well—
What happened was back in 1995, action was finally taken and there was a law passed that required payments to be made, and it set up what was called a continuing appropriation. So if the legislature didn't set aside a dime, the comptroller and the treasurer would automatically send this money to the retirement systems, which was good. The difficulty was that the payment schedule was arranged like a balloon mortgage. It was really low at the beginning, so the folks who enacted it really didn't have to bear the brunt of living up to its terms, and it escalated over time. To Quinn's credit, he proposed, and the legislature went along with, putting in the amount of money that was required under this 1995 law each of his years as governor. But because of the ramp-up, the contribution became so great that, as Quinn famously said, it was squeezing out other things like some kind of a python.
Right. And obviously during the Blagojevich era, we had so-called pension holidays, which gets back to that thing of wanting to provide services, wanting to expand health care to kids,
and to do
not
that,
wanting to pay
for
it.
They actually went back and amended the 1995 law that said, here's the formula we're going to follow. But, oh, we're going to take a holiday for these 2 years, and we're going to put in excess of $2 billion less than what we should.
So Jamie, I want to turn to you. This law was intended to relieve some of that pressure that Charlie was talking about, the increase in the payments. But the legislature did not count on these savings, right? We still haven't attempted to book these savings in the law yet or in the budgeting process yet, I should say.
No, the legislative leaders knew that this was going to be a long court battle. Folks were uncertain as to whether it would hold up, and now it hasn't. So they did not build in the savings for the current fiscal year, which turns out was a pretty good idea.
Yeah, because there would be a huge hole right now. Amanda, I'd like to turn to you on that score. Governor Rauner has proposed further changes to the pension system, and he did propose counting those savings, $2.2 billion worth, I think.
Exactly, $2.2 billion worth, and that's been really from the onset, the very first criticism that you heard from anybody and everyone regarding the governor's budget plan, as has been evidenced by this litigation. There's no way that you can, just because you pass a bill, there's no way to say that it will stand, and even if it were to, that takes years to go through the court system. It is worth noting, of course, that Rauner says he believes his plan is more constitutional or that it is different. Of course, there's a lot of disagreement there, House Speaker Michael Madigan having a different mindset. But Rauner says that his plan actually may be okay with the courts because it does not reduce previously earned pension benefits. It just basically pauses at all teachers, public employees, university employees, such as everybody on this panel. It would freeze benefits that had already been earned and then change them going forward. Unions adamantly against that, as I said. That's just the governor's take.
Well, and I think a clear reading of the Supreme Court opinion today is that that's not going to pass muster either.
So right. We've had for so long legislators waiting for the Supreme Court opinion saying that they wanted it to provide clues as to what they could do going forward. And they've got now 38 pages of them, basically. And really a slow reaction coming from this. We do have the Senate President, John Cullerton, who had from initially wasn't really a fan of this prescription. He'd been working with unions to try and craft another one. In his statement reacting to the Supreme Court's decision, Cullerton says, kind of points that out, kind of we get in, I told you so. He goes on to say it's a victory for retirees, public employees, and everyone who respects the plain language of our Constitution, but he says it should be balanced against the grave financial realities we will continue to face without true reforms.
And I do want to emphasize something Amanda said earlier. All of us are employees of the University of Illinois Springfield, and we are therefore on this panel today members of the state university retirement system. So is there, Charlie, I do want to turn to you. Amanda pointed out that lawmakers had been saying they were going to look for guidance for the Supreme Court. Now they have 38 pages of it. You have talked in the past about, you think that some people might have passed this legislation knowing it was unconstitutional, looking for political cover.
Yeah, and I mean, the guidance that the court basically gave him was the Constitution means what it says. And so you can do whatever you want, but from the moment someone enters a public employee retirement system, it's not just state workers. In fact, the largest retirement system that we have covers every public school teacher outside the city of Chicago. Whatever the terms and the benefits, when you begin employment, those remain in place in terms of your pension rights for as long as you live, and they can't be retroactively changed. They can be enhanced, presumably, but they can't be reduced or diminished because that's what the Constitution says in pretty clear language. And so anybody who was hoping that the court would say, oh, here's a way you can get around it, I think they're going to be sadly disappointed.
Well, and under the state made a police powers argument that was, we are in such a crisis that we know that those are the rules and that you'll probably see it that way, But we have no other options. This is a dire situation. And the court pretty roundly rejected that argument because there were other options discussed when this legislation was passed. One of the things, as I mentioned earlier, the themes that I keep kind of seeing through this is the court saying it's your job to sort this out in a way that doesn't violate the Constitution. And one of the really strong statements in it was that crisis is not an excuse to abandon the rule of law. It is a summons to defend it. How we respond to the measure of our commitment to the principles of justice we are sworn to uphold. That's pretty strong language going to the General Assembly of you know, just because you may think there is a crisis doesn't mean that the Constitution is just going to be tossed aside.
Well, and years ago, several decades ago, there was a Supreme Court opinion that came down in a case raised by some plaintiffs arguing that their pensions might be in jeopardy because the state was not adequately funding the retirement systems. And the gist of that opinion was it doesn't matter whether they're funded or not. What counts is they got to pay your benefits.
Well, we will be talking more about pensions in the weeks to come, I'm sure. Coming up, ready or not, the House begins debating the governor's turnaround agenda, and Governor Rauner addresses the Chicago City Council. You're listening to State Week.
Support for State Week in Review comes from Illinois Issues Magazine, deciphering Springfield legislation and the state of the state. Information at illinoisissues.uis.edu.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky by phone, and Jamie Dunn. I'm Brian Mackey. Well, Amanda, this week the House began debating the governor's agenda, whether or not he wanted them to. They started with workers' compensation. Can you tell us what is a committee of the whole and set the scene a little bit for what happened?
So a committee of the whole is basically just a hearing in front of the entire House versus normally when the legislature is debating bills or subject matter, it is separated. You have, you know, an education committee, a finance committee, a higher ed committee, what have you. This instead brings all members of the House together to hear discussion on a topic that for whatever reason is worth importance to all membership. That's where we can read into this here. Was this a hearing that there's going to be a serious vote on, and Madigan therefore wanted testimony to be heard by all members before they took a vote, or really was this more of a stage on which he could bring out injured workers and almost be speaking not just to the members of the House but to the public at large and to Governor Bruce Rauner about where he stands on workers' compensation? And the prevailing wisdom is that really it was done for the latter. This wasn't a debate on a bill. It was kind of parading people who would be on the opposite side of Rauner on workers' compensation in front of the House. And Republicans didn't like that so much.
So, Jamie, didn't we just fix workers' compensation a few years ago? Why is this an issue now again?
Yes, Governor Pat Quinn really took up the issue, and it was a pretty long negotiated process. So it maybe didn't go as far as some folks thought that it could, especially what Governor Rauner is asking for now. What they call causation was kind of a deal breaker for some of the Democrats, which is, you know, saying that an injured worker would have to prove that most of the injury was acquired in the workplace. Cutting money to doctors who see workers' comp patients. Republicans, that was kind of a deal breaker for them. Both of those things are things that Governor Rauner would like to see happen now. The Democrats who were a part of that original deal feel that the workers' comp insurance companies aren't passing along enough of the savings, and they say that if these companies would pass along the savings, we'd probably be in a lot better shape. But then businesses and some Republicans are saying, no, we need a law that goes a little further than that deal did.
So, Charlie, the Speaker also put up a bunch of budget bills this week, but this is a tactic we've seen him use in the past, in the recent past, even with the concealed carry debate, pensions, some other things, where he's had a series of these kind of test votes or trial balloons, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the pension legislation we were talking about earlier, he did the exact same thing. There were a number of different ideas, and they were all tested.
I seem to remember that some of them got zero votes or one vote. I think he was the only one to vote
and,
for.
And what he did with the budget was he initially offered an amendment that in essence embodied the governor's proposed budget. That got zero votes. All the Democrats voted no. All the Republicans who were there voted present. And then they began offering a series of amendments. I think there were something like 16 all told, each of them dealing with a particular agency and a funding level for that agency above what the governor wanted. And again, it was a case of the Democrats supporting them, the Republicans voting present, and they actually stopped the process about halfway through so that they could go to the House-Senate softball game. But it was a way to kind of try and paint Republicans in the corner. And I think maybe on a larger scale, it was Madigan's trying to remind the governor that he, in fact, runs the House and that the governor's proposals really don't have much favor even among a lot of House Republicans, particularly Republicans from downstate who have a lot of union workers in their district and who do not like this, and the workers do not like the governor's focus on trying to cripple organized labor.
So, Amanda, the governor has talked about, you know, he thinks that the legislature should take up his entire agenda. I was thinking back to the State of the State address where he said, don't think of this as a list of individual bullet points or items. Think of it as an entire package. So he's kind of taken this all or nothing approach. Does this help or hurt negotiations with the governor on that and the budget?
You know, it's really hard to judge at this point. On one hand, you have to figure that the statements that Rauner has made, his budget cuts, have really angered a lot of legislators, as well as their target audiences, particularly on the Democratic side. So is this an exercise for, you know, Democrats to show trial lawyers, for example, hey, we're with you, and look at this, and is it that? And is that enough to quash any sort of negotiations? Or we still have working groups continuing to meet. We haven't actually seen any legislation filed by Bruce Rauner. Maybe this isn't a death knell. There's still room. It's just kind of an opening salvo to, again, appease Madigan's key constituencies, and also a message from Madigan to the governor, get going. It's in May now. You still haven't filed any legislation yourself, and we want to see some of that. So workers' comp was this week, but we're going to have more of that ahead. Madigan has scheduled for Tuesday another committee of the whole to look at the civil justice system with this similar sort of message. Rauner saying basically trial lawyers, you know, are corrupt for the campaign contributions they have made. Madigan saying, look at what the civil justice system do. This we don't need tort reform. These are injured people who need the protections of the court. And further, Madigan says that he is going to have a debate on right to work next week, urging Rauner again to file some sort of legislation because we haven't seen any. So it's not just workers' comp. It's piece by piece here.
Well, Amanda, I was also wanted to, I'm glad you mentioned right to work, because the governor is continuing to make his case for what he is calling local empowerment zones, right to work zones. Unions call them right to work for less money zones. And he was at the Chicago City Council saying, and his message was, for Chicago to get what it wants, Illinois must get what it needs. Can you? This is a pretty unprecedented visit. Can you talk a little bit about what he was doing up there?
So, yeah, this was unprecedented. There's no known time when a governor went before aldermen like this. It was similar to the message that we've had before, but he said, you know, I care about Chicago. I love this city, as he says he loves the state. But Chicago wants a lot of changes. You have Rahm Emanuel that's asking for a city-owned casino. He also wants to sort of decouple from the pensions. He says Chicago taxpayers are paying twice because they're paying for everybody else's pension benefits, and then because Chicago teachers are not included in Senate Bill 1 or any of these other changes that Chicago taxpayers have to pay twice, they want to get out from under that. Rauner saying, the state can't afford this, and we're not going to be able to unless you work hand in hand with me. So he really tried to promote his turnaround agenda. Didn't work. Obviously, you have a whole lot of Democrats on that Chicago City Council, pretty much entirely, and the city council, right afterward, granted it was a lame duck version, but voted down the turnaround agenda. So sending another strong message there of lines in the sand.
But this is one of the things when you hear people speak positively of the governor that you hear is that he is willing to meet with people. He's willing to put in the FaceTime. He's willing to sit down with people who really strongly oppose a lot of his opinions and a lot of his agenda. And, you know, I don't know how far that's going to get him, but it's definitely something that early in his term, people seem to at least respect and appreciate, given that maybe that wasn't going on as much under Pat Quinn.
Yeah, I would look at it as a great photo opportunity for the governor. He goes up and he lectures the city council and Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and it plays well downstate. I don't think it accomplished anything. It's pretty clear that the Chicago City Council is not going to adopt a turnaround agenda. In fact, Rahm Emanuel said that he would work against right to work. There would never be right to work in Chicago, and he would come down here to Springfield to work against it. So it,
but, of course,
to me,
a lot of this is base appeasement. You know what I mean? It's not just, is it actually going to work? Is the Chicago City Council going to turn around? No. But Rauner can say to his public, to the high-dollar donors who've given to him, look at what I did. I went to, quote-unquote, the lion's den, as he phrased it, and he's given his all. It's all, I think that you can't dismiss the notion of the public messaging that is all
well,
behind
that's what
it.
I, well, that's what I said. It's a great, ruling. It's a great photo op. It's all about he's still on the campaign trail, and at some point, one would hope he'd sit down and decide, okay, the campaign's over. I won. Now it's time for me to be the governor.
Sending.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you look at Madigan's doing all of this.
But Charlie's right. Like when you look at his daily schedule, it still very much looks like a campaign schedule. And I think everyone's starting to wonder when that's going to change.
Very similar to Pat Quinn. You know, I mean, these are two very, very different men. But I think that you see this, and actually similar to Blagojevich, too, frankly. How much do they want to get in the weeds, or how much do they like going around making appearances, getting applauded at? And there is very much that consistent theme. They're all politicians, of course.
But think about that for a minute. Does Rauner want to be compared to Pat Quinn and Rod Blagojevich?
Or I'm not saying it's a good idea.
Wouldn't it be better for him to be compared to a Jim Thompson or a Jim Edgar who actually got something done?
One would think. You know, I will say that despite that, he is going around a lot in public. He has not. That's a fair criticism. He has not introduced any of these bills. There haven't been movements. Rauner continues to make an effort to speak with individual legislators, more so than Blagojevich or Quinn did. He continues to call them, to meet with them at the mansion. So whereas his public schedule is a lot of just that public, and there haven't been any sort of big agreements or negotiations or really any notion that the governor is in there, he has for sure been doing more in that regard than his two past predecessors, it appears.
All right, time now for notes from the field. Charlie, if you have about 15 seconds today.
Well, a quick one. The Civic Federation came out and pretty much was quite critical of the governor's budget. They said that it did not appear to be achievable or prudent. And they questioned his counting pension savings that aren't going to happen. And they also said they didn't like the cuts he was proposing in some human service programs that would lead to further costs down the line.
And I'm going to take the prerogative and do the last one myself. It was a big deal for criminal justice reform advocates when in 2012 the U.S. Supreme Court ruled life without parole for juveniles was unconstitutional. First up for resentencing in Illinois was Adolfo Davis, now 38. He's serving life for a double murder he committed or was part of when he was 14. He's been in prison for 24 years and is the first of about 80 juveniles expected to be resentenced, but that is not to be. A Cook County judge basically resentenced him to life without parole this week. Many more cases to come. That's our time for this edition of State Week. You can get a podcast of this show at wuis.org. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. For Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, and Jamie Dunn, I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.